As we get underway together today, I would like us to take a few moments to be in awe together. As always, this is an invitation, and you may do as you wish and as works for you, but my invitation to you this morning would be to take a few moments, and assuming you know how to take your pulse, which I think most of us do, at least sort of in a rudimentary way, either this artery, your carotid artery, the less common way, or on your wrist, the more common because it doesn't look so weird, maybe. But just, I would invite you to just take the two fingers of one hand and put them on your pulse for a few moments and just be still and attend to your heartbeat. Just be aware of the marvel that is biological and spiritual life, that pulse is very close to whatever we would call the center of reality for us as biological persons and beings. It's also mysteriously something that we share a connection to. A bunch of us are in a room long enough, the science would say that our pulses become closer together in tempo. They start to line up. Anyway, for now, since we're not together in a room, let's just be still for a few moments and pay attention, be mindful of the beating of our hearts and the wonder that that is, all right? So let's be still together. And I would invite you to bring to mind someone else whose heart you would love to see continue beating in this world, someone you care about and wish to hold in mind and heart and spirit this morning. Hold space for their life, the things in it that might be perilous, but that are also beautiful and good. Thank you. Peace, everyone. When we do things like that, they can feel like, you know, whatever. That's kind of woo-woo, Tim. Well, really, no more woo-woo than that pulse, it seems to me, which is an utter wonder. And the ways in which we are connected that we cannot see or know, what our contemporary science tells us about the nature of reality is that it's not only stranger than we imagine, but stranger than we can imagine. And I feel like that opens up possibilities in terms of how we understand who we are and how we're connected that are important to explore. All right, so on to something much more kind of, industrial complexy. I know that getting your driver's license isn't the same kind of rite of passage that it once was. And it's amazing to me how fast values around that intersection have shifted in this part of the world. My late father-in-law liked to tell a story, and I can't recall in the moment whether it was a story about him personally or about someone he knew, but I think it was about him going to get his driver's license and his dad taking him down to the licensing agent and the licensing agent looking at his dad and saying, "Can he drive?" His dad saying, "Yep." And the agent sort of, you know, writing out the driver's license and handing it over. Another story was about the testing agent saying to, you know, the person who wanted their license, "All right, I'm hopping in, drive around the barn." I drove around the barn. Looked good. Gave him his license. It's a little bit more of a process these days, but if I think about how things have moved from that, here's your license without, a lot of process to my experience, which involved, driver's ed and tests and things like that. But I went to get my driver's license, like my full driver's license, the day after my birthday, and then promptly used it to drive halfway across the prairies. And now I've got kids who, adult kids who don't want to have no desire for a car. Well, that's quite a shift, right? And these are cultural markers, these things, right? And like lots of cultural markers, the history of this one, of a driver's license, is all tangled up with things like the post-war emphasis on youth as a cultural category. Don't know if you knew, but I mean, adolescence as an idea didn't kind of exist until fairly recently. The strong push toward individual independence that was part of that movement, the sexual revolution, post-war economic boom, these things are kind of all tangled up with how big a deal it has been in the past to get a driver's license. And lots of those things are markers of bygone eras and their values. But some values seem to have endured better than others, and among them, to the degree that people are still getting driver's licenses and learning how to drive, among them, the value of passing along at least some of your hard-won, parental experience to the young drivers in the family. Now, I am not going to name names, but I think it would be fair to say that in our family, different kids have responded differently to that input, and the range of responses had varied from something that I could call grudging acceptance to enthusiastic desire. So sort of from, all right, parent, I get that it's your job to do this, passing on and experience things, so can we get on with it? To at the other end of the spectrum or continuum, something more like, yes, please tell me everything you know because I want to do this right. And you're the person who knows how to do it right. So here's the thing. For me, there are some things that I'm going to pass along to any of my new to driving kids just because I love them. I'm not doing it because they love to hear it. I'm not doing it because I'm trying to win cool dad points. I'm doing it because the road can be an exhilarating place and it can also be a dangerous place. And my desire for these ones that I love is that they would get to experience maximum exhilaration. That's exhilaration, not acceleration, at least not in my car. Thanks very much. With minimum danger, that they would experience optimum freedom of movement with as little risk of collision or accident or harm as possible. So the short version is to my young drivers, I'm going to say, listen, this is a dangerous intersection. So when you have to navigate this one, double down on looking both ways and especially be aware of hazard X. And I'm going to do that because I love the person that is holding the wheel. Okay, sometimes an illustration comes to mind and I write it all down and then I think, well, that analogy worked at some points and it failed at others. So, in the interest of disclosure about process, I think that illustration works when it comes to illustrating motivation, but I think it fails when it comes to illustrating positional authority. Let me unpack that a little bit. I've got something that I want to explore in our talky bit today that feels like it's analogous to a danger or potentially dangerous intersection. And I want to explore it because I love the people that I'm journeying with. So far, so good in terms of the illustration working. But I'm not your dad. I'm not your authority figure. And if you think I am, we should talk about that soon, before you get to know me well and get disillusioned and bail. I'm not some kind of high voltage expert. I'm a fellow explorer. And yet, somehow, in the structure of our shared exploration, you've entrusted me with poking around out there every week and bringing back the things that I've found so we can consider them together. And some of what I've been finding feels like it could be compared to a higher risk intersection, to places to watch out for. Not so we stop exploring, but so we do it with our heads up and our eyes open and our minds and our spirits focused rather than distracted. So that's the positional part, and the motivation is about that, continuing to explore and doing it as well as we can. On the topic generally that I'm moving into, There's a bit of a collection of proverbial wisdom on this topic that kind of cuts to the chase in ways that I think are worth noting and unpacking. And I've sourced these from the wisdom traditions that I know the best, which would be collected together in Hebrew and Christian sacred texts. So Proverbs 26, 27, there's this great little pithy aphorism. Can we just acknowledge that everyone does this? Those who dig a pit will fall into it, and those who roll stones, it will come back on them. Second part. I can't help picturing the stick figure version of the person rolling a stone and going, look what I, you know. Anyway, for some reason I find that a little bit amusing, but of course it could hurt a great deal. Psalms 7:15, and I'll use the masculine pronouns here, but do expand them. He has dug a pit and hollowed it out and has fallen into the hole which he made. And maybe we should stay with the masculine pronouns. Maybe there's a maybe there is a gendered inclination here that we need to acknowledge. I'm not sure. I think we're all fair game on this one. Here's my favorite. Partly because I just like the straightforward vibe of Ecclesiastes, the kind of old guy on the porch vibe of the whole thing. And partly because of the second part of the proverb, which I'll expand a little bit. So Ecclesiastes 10:8. He who digs a pit may fall into it. We're already familiar with that particular warning. Part two, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. So one of the beauties of things like Proverbs is that they are not universally true. All right, they're wisdom about particular slices of life, sometimes quite narrow slices, quite circumstantial slices. And that's why you can easily find a proverb that says one thing in one verse and the opposite piece of advice in the very next verse in the collection. They're not elementary mathematical equations where if you add up the numbers, you get a predictable result. Not the way they work. They're proverbs, which means they have to be interpreted, they have to be applied, they have to be tested, and then they have to be revised for the circumstance. So in that spirit, around those texts, let's go exploring. So what is this pit of which I speak? What's this hole we might dig for someone else that we might fall into ourselves? And I mean, it's a movie trope, among other things, right? It's a way of structuring plot ideas, you know, the elaborate con that backfires, that kind of thing. So it's an enduring proverbial metaphor. Well, maybe if we take part two of the Ecclesiastes one, what's the wall that we're trying to break through? And what's the serpent that might bite us just as we feel like we're accomplishing our hard-won goal of living beyond the constraints of this metaphorical wall? Well, as always, there's lots of ways we might answer those questions, but for now, I just want to invite you to consider this. Let's say that the wall in that proverb is a barrier to finding beliefs that we can live with. A song that we can sing in our own company, to use one of my favorite, all-time favorite lines from U2. So we come up against this wall, which is comprised in our lived experience of ideas and practices that feel to us like they fence us or other human beings in. They block out the light. They do harm to those seeking freedom to be who they are, or even to those just trying to be accepted as fully human for who they are. And we can see that many people have been broken on this wall. They've been harmed by crashing into it. They've been, their growth has been muted by the deep, unremitting shadow it casts. We ourselves might bear the wounds of struggling with it. So to us, it looks like a problem. And so we start to take it apart. We deconstruct it one stone at a time. And it's hard. We have bruised palms. We have bloody knuckles. And to make matters worse, there are people right beside us looking at the same wall, and they are praising it for providing stability and right boundaries. And they think we should be honoring it and venerating it, pointing to it as a symbol of good instead of disassembling it. And some of them are people that we love, and that can be complicated and painful. But we are compelled, often by doubt, to keep on taking it down. And we're making progress, and then we move a particular rock, maybe one close to the foundation, and wham, we get bit by the serpent that was under the rock, and we find ourselves, and perhaps even the whole project, in jeopardy. You might have noticed I'm kind of liking using that old-fashioned word, serpent. Partly because it just sort of sounds deliciously ominous. And partly because in the context of its use in these ancient texts, it has a layered meaning. And the obvious meaning is, you know, snake, of which it's a synonym. And you can sort of tell when a synonym has shifted gears, right? Like, I mean, most of us, if we were in snake country and we got bit, we wouldn't be like, oh no, I've been bitten by a serpent. You know, we would use the word snake, but they're synonyms, right? So there's kind of that layer. And then there's the less common meaning of a sly or a treacherous person, particularly one that exploits a position of trust in order to betray it. We might still use that older word for, you know, sly as a serpent. And in addition to that, in the context of biblical texts, in particular the ancient Hebrew texts, the serpent was a symbol. And this is one of the reasons why I'm going to stick with this word this morning, is because it was a symbol of evil power and chaos from the underworld, and it was also a symbol of fertility and life and healing. And we still see that in the symbol that we use for physicians. So it's nice and complicated. A kind of, I think, a good fit for the process of exploring what we believe. So I'm going to stick with it. Turns out there are several possible serpents lurking in the wall, as I've applied that metaphor to exploring what we believe. And I'm not going to try to identify them all. This is not meant to be exhaustive, but I want to name a couple, which I think will probably be sufficient to stir our imaginations and help us consider other possibilities. Again, collaborative exploring is how I would look at, think at, and try to practice what I do in this community. So in a community like The Table, filled as it is with people that are often doing the work of honest inquiry, one of the serpents inside the wall is that of structure itself. When we look at religion in particular, we can see the damage done by unchallenged structures and institutions. Never mind the damage that can be done when harmful structures are equipped with a lot of power and resources, when they collaborate with the state, for instance. And we live in the middle of a growing awareness of the ferocious downside of that pretty much on a daily basis at this moment in history. We can easily see that organized religion far too often means the organizing of religion in such ways as best serves the interests of that religion rather than the common good of humanity. And we're so flooded with this reality, we're so awash in it, that we find it hard to trust any structure, including ones we make ourselves. In our commitment to tearing down the wall of destructive isms, we can get bit by the serpent of feeling the obligation to immediately deconstruct everything that we or those around us make. You could say that we are structurally inclined to deconstruct all structures, which is pretty much as circular as it sounds. Like I said, I'm just going to put these out there to get our imaginations going. I'm not going to unpack them in a whole bunch of detail. So a second serpent, despite my stated commitment to serpent-y things here, I kind of can't quite believe I'm doing a talky bit on serpents. So just a reminder, it's a metaphor. All right. The second serpent is that of authority. Now, your radar might be beeping about this already. You know, sort of along the lines of, is this the talky bit where we find out that The Table has just been a long game con aimed at sort of a softer-sided version of authoritarianism? Well, as always, you be the judge. But in terms of intent, that's not where I'm headed. And you already know what I think of treating somebody like an authority figure just because they happen to, you know, have the mic or the Facebook live stream at the moment. In terms of this stage schema that we've been, that's sort of been guiding our explorations for a while, we could make a contrast here. In stage one, we tend to be dependent or even codependent on authority figures. They tell us what the right thing is to believe or do, and that's what we strive to believe or do. In stage two, where we have this kind of pragmatic self-interest and we want to be with the winners, kind of at play. In stage two, we tend to look for people that can help us to succeed in our personal quest to be independent. Basically, winners that can help us be winners too. And so we, this is, for example, a stage where church hopping is a very common thing, right? Because why not? I mean, if that church doesn't seem to have the people in it who are going to help me in my quest, then I'm just going to pop over to this one because that's what'll help me in my quest. It's gonna, that's where the win is for me. So that's where I'm going. So that's kind of a stage two relationship with authority. And then stage three, as we considered last week, we tend to be counter-dependent. And it would be overstating it a little bit to say anti-dependent, but that's sort of the idea of counter, all right? And that means that we approach, among other things, we approach authority figures with suspicion. Always. One of the discernible results of that approaching authority figures with suspicion is that stage three groups, gatherings of stage three people, tend to use, exhaust, and discard the very people that they might have asked to provide leadership. And as I was writing this, I realized that it could sound like one of those left-handed, you know, this happens in sermons, right? Where this left-handed chastisement of a community by an authority figure. It's not how this one, this has no resonance for that for me in here at all. This is more of a trend and a thing to watch for if we're in a stage like that or we're a community in a stage like that. So the way that it can function is when we turn over the rock of authoritarianism, which we can readily agree needs to be taken out of the wall, that it's harmful, we are vulnerable to the sting of losing the value of leadership in the context of community. We might have become so used to top-down hierarchical, vertical, power-oriented leadership that we might not even be able to recognize the invitation to a collaborative leadership of equals when it's right in front of us because we're looking for the other thing, right? Having thought about that idea for a bit over the course of the week as I was writing this, I found myself feeling like I couldn't help but wonder if the inability to recognize that invitation to collaborative leadership might not actually be a good thing. This is pretty oblique, so stay with me. I'll see if I can sum it. If we can't tell that we are functioning as partners in collaborative leadership, maybe we won't feel compelled to tear apart something that helps us all do better work together on disassembling things that really do need to be deconstructed. Did that make sense? Could you follow that? So maybe a little self-deception is going to help us keep doing together something that really needs doing rather than ripping it all apart back to counter-dependent kind of a stance regarding authority. Or another way to say the whole thing would be to say that maybe that could help us act in ways that put such authority as we are entrusted with by a community to good use, to healthy use, because we don't know that that's what we're doing. We don't recognize it, or we just rip it apart. Anyway. There are still more serpents in the wall. So, the third one is purpose. Here's the thing. Action, meaningful action in the world, in the now, tends to require a sense of purpose. Because sometimes it's hard, right? It can take a lot of oomph to keep pushing into something meaningful, when we're not getting results, let's say. And in stage three, we can get so practiced in critique and deconstruction that we lose sight of the discernible fact, I'm going to say, that confidence and arrogance are not the same thing. Hubris, which is a word that I often find myself using because it feels like the right one to reach for in so many circumstances in this conversation, hubris means excessive pride or excessive confidence, arrogance. In Greek tragedy, hubris refers to excessive pride or defiance of the gods, of the divine, and it leads to nemesis. It might take us a while to get there, but one of the things we're going to explore, if my inclinations come to fruition sometime in the months to come, is an idea about the correlation between what we would use God language for and reality, how those are actually the same thing. And so to put it into that Greek framework, hubris is defiance of reality. Anyway, back to this confidence idea. So we can be confident enough to act without being so arrogant that we stop examining our own actions for their weaknesses, flaws, and blind spots, and inviting other people to do the same. Is that a painful process? Yes. Does it require that we trust others? Yes. See previous serpents re authority and leadership. Again, not vertical, but collaborative, right? Among equals, but still to say to somebody, lead this idea for me. Help me take it somewhere that I can't. Help me see something about it that I am blind to. One of our kids, Kale, is in the thick of the latter processes of finishing a novel, and a formal process that includes a team of people, a vocational project for them. And they have a group of folks that they trust that are competent in this regard, that have all read this book from an edit with an editorial eye, and come back to Kale to say to them, you know what, this chapter needs to go. This character needs to behave differently here for this idea to actually work. Like big, bold, I know you wrote this and it's your baby, but this doesn't work kind of feedback. I have enormous admiration for Kale as a person and as an author in that process, and I'm intrigued by their joy in handing their work over to other people that they trust and saying, have at it, because I want the thing that I'm making here in the end to be the best that it can be. And it cannot be the best that it can be if I just sit alone in a room and make it. I think that's fascinating. I think that's powerful. Adam Grant, I want to say, is the author of a book in which one of the ideas that he talks about is he says, I think I've mentioned this before, we'll explore this sometime too because it's just so intriguing. We can argue like we're convinced we're right, and we can listen like we know we're wrong. Those things are not mutually exclusive. I mean, in stage one they are, but I think we can grow beyond that, even though we have to return to it sometimes when we're doing light switchy things in our life, on-off things, right? But the development of what we believe is not a binary, it's not an on-off switchy thing. It's way more complex than that. If we don't learn to do something like this, then we should probably keep our eye out for that feeling of being too wobbly to act purposely, because we just might be suffering from the poison of purposelessness. It's very, very hard to retain a sense of purpose if we're always taking things apart to the point where we can't lean into anything. All right, two more. In stage three, we often embrace what we might broadly call relativism. That's your point of view, and as such, it's valid, that sort of a stance. We're aware, for example, I'm aware increasingly as I learn about the impacts of this, that I'm white and privileged. And as a white privileged person, I tend to see what's visible from that vantage point, and it tends to be a downward gaze, frankly. It's from a vantage point that not everyone holds. If we're poor and marginalized, then we may see things from the point of view of being oppressed. And I can't illustrate this from personal experience except in such small, incremental, infinitesimal ways as to be an insult to the truly impressed, or oppressed, rather. Being attenuated to those kinds of dynamics can make it pretty tough to really wholeheartedly belong, to deeply engage in anything that smacks of being a group. We tend to be, in stage three, we tend to be more comfortable on the fringes of things than we are at the center, because that feels more consistent with our mission of thinking critically. And we might even prefer, and some of us have had this experience and are having this experience, we might even prefer to be on the fringes of a bunch of groups as part of a sociological, archaeological mission, like a dig. We're on this mission to gain a variety of viewpoints, and we understand that to be a worthy enterprise. The stone that we're trying to pull from this damaging wall is the short-sightedness or even the blindness that comes from being surrounded by groupthink, that comes from living in a bubble that reinforces the same ideas over and over without challenging them. That thing, can bite us in the process. And the way that it can bite us is that we can get to a place where we don't know how to, or maybe even know how to want to belong to a community of care, or as we've talked about it here before, a community of affection. We can poison our own human need for belonging, and then we can find ourselves wondering why we feel so lonely and depressed when we also feel like we're doing the work we need to do to grow as persons. So it's a thing to watch for. All right, last of the bitey things for today. I'm sure you can think of your own, of course, and if you just turn your well-honed critical faculties toward this set of problems, others will emerge, and critique of the way I've laid these out will emerge as well, as it should. The last of the lurking nastinesses, though, that I want to mention today is one I'm going to call suspicion. If we find ourselves disillusioned with things like structure and authority and organizational purpose and belonging, we might also find ourselves operating in a world where our starting point for all of our experiences increasingly is suspicion. We know, we cannot be honest and deny that organizations can foster injustice. They can foster oppression. They can foster hypocrisy. We are surrounded every moment by the evidence that this is the case. So when we enter a new setting, anything that's organized enough to enter as organized, we come in with our, how is this not what it appears to be, radar on high alert. And not surprisingly, when we come in looking for problems, hey-ho, we find them. This could sound, what I'm about to say could sound like it dismisses all that, and it, in my mind at least, it does not. But I do want to keep it complicated because I think it is. I don't know any perfect people. And I've certainly never been part of a group where getting imperfect people together made all of us better in the sense of perfect. Like it undid the imperfections. Messy people make messy organizations. Messy people and messy organizations make messy cultures. This is gravity. It's not an excuse for those things, but I feel it's a valid organization. I can remember Tim Penner saying at one point, talking about both Canada as an idea and Christianity as an idea, they both seem like really great ideas. It just seems like nobody's quite managed to enact them or bring them to full being yet. Yeah, that kind of complexity, right? Well, here's the serpent part in that. If we turn this kind, this is where this gets a little convoluted, but you might have had an experience of this. And if this can put words around it, then that would be good. If we turn this kind of suspicious scrutiny on ourselves, perhaps in the interest of continuing to be honest in our own explorations, we can end up becoming disillusioned with our own disillusionment, skeptical of our own skepticism, suspicious of our own suspicions. We can get caught in this kind of self-defeating loop. And then what? Like when that happens, what's next? Well, despair is an option. We could just give up on tearing down the wall. So this is an all ages show. So we could say, as can't remember the character's name says in the Big Lebowski, bleep it, I'm going bowling. Like we could just, Tim Penner, thanks for reminding me of that moment in that film this week. We could end up there. I give up, I quit. And I was talking to a friend this week who I was reminding him in the course of that conversation of times where we were working together, and I remember him sitting in front of his computer monitor wrestling with something that he was trying to solve. And I heard him say out loud, I give up. I can't do this anymore. I quit. Then you just sit there for a few minutes and he kind of lean back in, put his hands on the keyboard, go back to work. But that moment of that's it. I give up. I quit. That's one of the places we could end up when we get caught in this loop of suspicions of our suspicions, doubting our own, the validity of our own intentions, of our own actions, tired of scrutinizing everything to the point where he's like, bleep it, I'm going bowling. Bowling is a metaphor for despair. There's another thing that can happen, and does, in discernible ways, and that is that in this stage three morass of kind of being stuck in this loop, some of us kind of walk away from the project of deconstructing the wall, and we walk. We just kind of like, I need to go for a walk, metaphorically, and we travel somewhere else, and we find in the wall a doorway constructed by sometimes a considerable effort, so it has a sense of welcome about it, by a stage one or stage two evangelist, that makes it relatively easy for us to give up on the project, go through the gate, through the door, and find ourselves on the other side of the wall with people that uniformly affirm its value and its merit and its rightness. And we can just let the project go. We can just give up. And if you're extending my mixed metaphors, you'll realize that for me, that's the equivalent of giving up and going bowling. But for many people, it's just a huge relief. I get to go back to being told what to believe and believing that. I get to go back to being told how to behave and behaving that. My authority figure can wrestle with the thorny questions of, yeah, but what about what happens to the oppressed in this story? Or, but what about the ways in which this becomes a vertical power hierarchy? Or whatever my thorny questions are. I don't have to wrestle with those in stage one environments because my authority figure does that. Whew. What a relief. No more stones to move. No more serpents to watch out for. That could happen. Or we could take a step back and nurse our wounds for a bit, contemplate the possibility that we're not done yet, that the same dynamics of deconstruction, suspicion, and relativism that can get us snake bit can also move us forward on our journey, rather than becoming the outlines of a new place where we get and stay stuck. The serpent, you may recall, can be a symbol of both chaos and healing, of both death and fertility. Maybe to use a slightly updated Jesus metaphor, we're making something new, but we don't have a suitable container for it yet. And maybe the container that's suitable for it won't look like a container at all. In the sense that it won't constrain it as much as it will support it, so it can continue to expand outwards. But in any case, the container we had doesn't work for it. It's new wine, and it's not going to work in old wineskins. And so we're going to end up having to make that too. When I think about it this way, where I tend to arrive in my spirit and in my life is with the idea that this could take some time. This could take some time, and it's best not done alone. So even though it's sometimes very, very difficult to do, let's keep one another company while we work it out. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you.